Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia? Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't
you
know
we're gonna have a... Started to burn too many things we found. That's the fabulous Dar Williams with Pete Seeger and David Burns singing the Solartopia song. And we got a lot to talk about with Solartopia today. We're in the midst of some really, really serious big-time battles over nuclear power plants that will determine the future of human life on this Earth. There's no doubt about it. We have two victories to discuss and celebrate, I suppose. Then we have some battles, especially in Ohio, New York, and California, to go deep, 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 deep into. So I have three of the best people on Earth to be able to do that with. Libby Halevy, are you with us?
I am, Harvey. Thank you.
Wonderful. And you and I are out here in Los Angeles. Kevin Camps, have you joined the crew here?
Hey, Harvey. I'm here.
Kevin, and you're, I assume, in Washington, D.C.?
I am.
Am I correct?
Yes.
Okay, good. And Tim Judson? Tim, you with us?
I sure am. Thanks, Harvey.
Okay, so we've got a full hour here, and we have a ton to cover, and it's all very real, very tangible. We are in the midst of a very, well, we got a constitutional crisis going on in Washington, D.C., with the first really serious attempt by an individual to make himself a dictator since Richard Nixon, and before that, Woodrow Wilson. The only one that was really successful, actually, was Woodrow Wilson. And we could do a couple, three weeks on what's happening in D.C. But in some ways, more important is what's happening at the grassroots nuclear power sites. And Libby Halevy, you are the host of the Nuclear Hot Seat, and you have a book, Yes, I Go in the Dark, which is a really fabulous piece of work. I really, really enjoyed it. I learned a lot from it, and I have a tremendous empathy for you because you were at Three Mile Island when it was going off. Now, I went into central Pennsylvania the year after the accident. I would not have gone there during the accident, but I figured it was reasonably safe after the accident, a year later, and I'm still alive, thankfully, to talk about it. When I was there, actually, they vented some krypton gas from the reactor, and there was a cartoon in the local paper that showed Superman falling down out of the sky. I'll never forget that cartoon. But we have received notice in yesterday's New York Times that Three Mile Island Unit 1 will finally shut, and it will shut apparently in September. Now, this month, we're going to celebrate the shutdown of the Plymouth reactor, Pilgrim in Plymouth, Massachusetts. With those two shutdowns, we're going to go to 96. There are 98 reactors, to my understanding, operating in the United States today. So Pilgrim and then TMI-1 will take us down to 96. But can you tell us, and Tim and Kevin, I know you're used to patiently waiting. Sometimes, by the way, when we have three guests, one of them has a hard time hearing. So if one of you has a hard time hearing, I'm sorry about that, but we'll just have to proceed. But Libby Halevy, you were in central Pennsylvania during the Three Mile Island accident, and now all these years later, Unit 1, which did not melt down, is going to shut. How does that make you feel?
Well, first of all, I'm ecstatic that the bailout didn't work. that it is being shut down because it deserves to be shut down. It should have been shut down a long time ago, but I'll take it as soon as we can get it. The fact that it is scheduled to shut down no later than the day after my birthday at the end of September just gives me reasons to, you know, light a couple of extra candles with it. And I was literally 1 mile away visiting friends. I was living in Los Angeles and traveled there when it happened. And there is no adequate way to explain to somebody who hasn't been through it or something comparable the level of absolute terror and fear and the lingering doubts about health and safety that happen as a result of being in such a situation. It certainly changed my life, and I know that it's a good thing that a further meltdown didn't happen, a further accident didn't happen, but we have had 40 years now of the continuous generation of nuclear waste on that site, plus it has only recently started to come out what the health impact was on the people who lived there. And the government isn't interested in finding out about this. The officials aren't interested. The only people who are interested in this are those who have been affected through the Three Mile Island Survivor Facebook page. And, you know, those people can never be given back. I cannot be given back all that was taken away as a result of having gone through that experience and the aftermath of it. And I am delighted. I'm dancing the happy dance today. And, of course, then we shift into what do we do with the waste. But we at least get 24 hours of absolute celebration.
Tim Judson, you want to comment on the shutdown of Three Mile Island Unit 1?
Sure. Well, you know, it couldn't be a more fitting conclusion to the debate that's been happening over the last few months in Pennsylvania about whether the state was going to pass legislation to give a massive subsidy to the operators of nuclear power plants in the state just in order to keep Three Mile Island operating. And thanks to the incredible work of grassroots groups like Three Mile Island Alert and others in Pennsylvania, that legislation isn't moving fast enough, and Exelon is raising the white flag on TMI, and we're finally going to get that plant shut down so that, and opening up the possibility for the cleanup to finally start 40 years after the meltdown.
Kevin Camps?
Well, I've been thinking about Judith Johnsrud all day since the news came out about the closure. And she was a founder of NEARS, where Tim is executive director, and she was a founder of Beyond Nuclear, where I work. And she has many claims to fame, but one of them was that with her Environmental Coalition on Nuclear Power, they intervened against the building of Three Mile Island in the first place. You know, it's one of these told-you-so kind of moments. March 28, 1979, the meltdown happened, but years before that, there were good people like Judy who were fighting to prevent such a disaster from happening. And then, like you mentioned, the radioactive releases in the aftermath of the meltdown, Harvey, she fought that. And another thought that comes to mind about Judith is something that Levy said, and that is the waste that's now at the site as well as the contamination. Judith was one of the hardest nuts to crack in the country on hardened on-site storage, which Tim was a pioneer at hammering out. I was involved with the Statement of Principles in 2006, and she would not sign those principles for a long time, and we had to strengthen them mightily until she would finally sign them. So I'm just remembering all those who devoted so much of themselves to fighting Three Mile Island even before the meltdown.
Well, I'm looking on my computer here, I'm looking at a picture of Jimmy Carter in the control room with his little yellow booties. And one of the small details about TMI that people always overlook is that on March 26, 1979, Jimmy Carter was in the Rose Garden with Anwar Sadat and Menachem Begin signing the Camp David Accords. And it would have appeared at the moment that Jimmy would have had a clear sailing into getting reelected in the second term, which would have stretched 1985, and TMI then melted within 36 hours of the signing of the Camp David Accords. And, of course, we had approached Jimmy Carter during the 76 campaign about nuclear power, and he said in the campaign that he was in favor of nuclear power if it met certain specifications. And Unit 2 was up for grabs at that time, and it met none of the specifications that Jimmy Carter laid out, but he let it go online anyway. And then, you know, it melted, as I say, 36 hours after Camp David, and it basically killed his presidency. And had it not been for TMI, the TMI accident, it's possible that Ronald Reagan would never have become president. And I have to say that if you told me in 1979 that after the Unit 2 went and there was an explosion inside Unit 2, and I'm going to contend, and I've always contended this, people argue there was a big question about why TMI did have the accident, and then, you know, people came to the various conclusions. The real question is why it didn't blow the roof off. And there's a school of thought that says the reason TMI didn't blow its top was because citizen activists in the fight over TMI Unit 2 and getting it licensed, unfortunately, had demanded that the containment at Unit 2 be extremely strong, you know, extra strong, because I don't know if the three of you have, but I've flown into TMI, into the Harrisburg airport, and when you do, you fly right over the nukes. And they demanded that containment be extra strong, and it's quite possible that the reason the TMI actually didn't blow its top was because the citizens had demanded a stronger containment. They might want to comment on that, Libby. Libby, do you know about that fight?
I remember reading about it, but of course the reading that I did was only long afterwards, actually since Fukushima, that I've been studying this. And yes, there was tremendous pressure beforehand to bring up the standards on it. And we all have to be thankful everywhere that citizen activists step forward and fight against nukes and force them into greater safety, because they are not figuring out what the impact is going to be on human life and on the safety of the environment. They're just looking at the bottom line. They're a bunch of bean counters, and they don't care about the consequences. They just care about the money.
Well, you know, corporations have only one genetic imperative, and that's to make money. And so that's what's been happening. I'll tell you, if you'd have told me that TMI Unit 1 would continue to operate for the next 40 years, I wouldn't have believed it. I'm still in shock that thing has continued to operate. And in this, Tim and Kevin, it's a huge victory for Citizen Action, which we can talk about in a minute. But I do want to get this in. I, as mentioned, I went to Central Pennsylvania. I was in, I think, January or February of 1980, and I spent the worst week of my life interviewing people there. And Libby, if I'd known you at the time, I would have interviewed you, and I have absolutely no doubt that people were killed by radiation at Three Mile Island. I sat across kitchen tables from people who were showing me their tumors, their hair falling out, telling me about their stillbirths, showing me. I stood across from TMI on the Middletown side, across the river, maybe 200 yards from the plant, and I held in my arms a dog, a black cocker spaniel, that had been born with no eyes. I mean, give me a break. Libby, what were your experiences health-wise, having been there in the middle of the accident?
My health impact is different from those who have lived there and were continuously exposed to what was released and was left in the ground and in the water. Because I was there for 3 days, we evacuated, I came back from two, and I flew out. So my impact was not continuous. However, in the aftermath of that, we've been able to track it down. The combination of whatever I got physically plus the emotional, which nobody ever bothers to factor in. What did this do to people emotionally? What did it do to their blood pressure? What did it do to their heart health? So many other things. In my case, it was my adrenal glands got fried, which led me to extremely low energy and inability to work in the world for many years when we were looking at the wrong diseases for what might have caused it. And only once it was identified that it was my adrenal glands and I could get the proper care for that, and that was only within the last 6 years, have I been able to come up to, if not my pre-team at Three Mile Island levels, certainly more than I had before, because I was basically unable to get through a day without three naps. So that was the way it impacted me physically.
Wow.
Mentally and emotionally, it shut me off from everything in the world. Truly, it was post-traumatic stress, and there was no way to deal with it.
Wow. I'm going to talk to Tim and Kevin now about the politics here. I do want to note the last sentence. It's so shocking. The last sentence of the New York Times article in yesterday's paper talking about this shutdown, the last sentence read, Exxon estimates that the plan to dismantle large components won't begin until 2074. I mean, here we are. We're dealing with these power generators. We're being told how wonderful they are for the national environment. They're not going to pull this thing apart for more than 50 years. I mean, you know, what kind of mindset is involved when you build a power plant and you can't even get into it for 50 years after it's shut? It's insane. All right, so let's talk now. We're in the critical moments here, especially in Ohio, but also elsewhere, in the battle to shut these existing reactors down. And we can talk about this later. I do not take particularly seriously. Well, I mean, I take it seriously, but I don't think there's any way that new reactors are going to be built in this country. Maybe one or two will slip through from Bill Gates' private bank account. I mean, talk about, you know, here we're seeing this spectacle. Everybody in this country assumes that if you have $1 billion, you're really smart. And we're seeing the spectacle of Donald Trump. And I want to add Bill Gates into that list. I mean, this guy is an idiot. I mean, he's got all this money and he wants to build new nuclear plants. I don't think it's going to happen, especially in like a Vogtle. But what's critical now is, and we'll turn to that, but what's critical now is the battle over the existing reactors. And this one, in not only is it significant for various, all sorts of reasons, because the TMI one is going to shut, but it's significant politically that we've won this battle. Tim Judson, do you want to talk about the basics of the political fight in Pennsylvania that led to the shutdown? And then, Kevin, please jump in.
Sure. Well, you know, the same thing has been happening in Pennsylvania for the last year that's been happening in other states where these old reactors have become uneconomical, and they're the companies that own them, these massive utility companies that have a tremendous amount of political power, have been squeezing state policymakers for multi-billion-dollar bailouts for these old reactors that are going to be shutting down, you know, within a few years anyway, and you know, essentially as a way to block the transformation of our energy system to relying on renewable energy which is poised to take place rapidly in the next few years unless something is done by the utility companies to stop it. And that's really what's going on with these bailouts. And what they do is, you know, essentially the companies have been playing on the fears of local politicians about job losses in their communities, you know, when these, you know, when these reactors shut down, and using that as a, you know, essentially as an excuse, to get hundreds of millions of dollars per year in subsidies from ratepayers, which is just totally counterproductive. And what's interesting about what's playing out in Pennsylvania is that, you know, that Pennsylvania isn't just a nuclear state, even though it's one of the most nuclear states in the country. But it's also an incredibly big fossil fuel state with fracking and coal, and so the coal and the natural gas, I mean the nuclear and natural gas companies, have been fighting with each other tooth and nail, you know, like these lumbering trolls, and sort of affecting the politics of the situation as well. So I think what we have is a combination of the chaos that's going on within the energy industry over the path forward with our energy supply, combined with the really valiant activism of local people who understand the risks of nuclear power and want to see it shut down.
Well, why, Kevin? Maybe you can jump in, and then back to Levy and Tim. Why did we win in Pennsylvania? what was the deciding factor that turned the legislature away from giving the money to Exelon to keep PMI-1 going?
Well, just realize that these battles go on. I mean, like Tim said, Pennsylvania is second only to Illinois in terms of number of reactors in a single state. And so if this news is true, and I hope it is, because remember, a lot of bait and switch has been played in New York, upstate New York, in Illinois, where certain closure dates were set only to use, like Tim said, as leverage to secure bailouts. The threat of job loss, the threat of tax revenue loss was used to secure bailouts, massive bailouts, $10 billion between New York and Illinois, all to the benefit of one company, Exelon Nuclear. So in Pennsylvania, Three Mile Island Unit 1 happened to be the only reactor in the state out of many that was not turning a profit, that was underwater. So all those other reactors are still after it. They would like to get the bailout. The same is true in Ohio. An ironic twist on the Ohio situation is that First Energy Nuclear not only has two reactors on the Lake Erie shore of Ohio, Davis-Bessey and Perry, they also own two reactors in Pennsylvania, just a few miles over the Ohio state line into Pennsylvania, getting towards Pittsburgh. That's Beaver Valley Units 1 and 2. And the proposed bailout in Ohio, which keeps morphing by the day, it seems, what's being proposed, is so loosely written that the $150 million per year that Ohio ratepayers would fork over to First Energy, this bankrupt company, money is fungible. It could even be used to prop up Beaver Valley Units 1 and 2 in Pennsylvania. So how's that for a trick move? Ohio ratepayers paying to subsidize reactors in Pennsylvania. So that's why I say I hope it's true. We're going to have to remain vigilant, but we're certainly going to have to remain vigilant on all these other reactors in Ohio and Pennsylvania that are still after those bailouts as we speak.
Well, yeah, I'm sure, if I can pile on that, it's, you know, what Kevin said is actually true. You know, we seem to have won round one over the Pennsylvania bailout with the closure of PMI. But what Exelon and the other nuclear companies have done in Pennsylvania has turned the debate from, you know, subsidizing TMI, you know, the smallest and most uneconomical nuclear plant in the state, to subsidizing all of the rest of them. And, you know, essentially Exelon seems to be sacrificing the one reactor that it doesn't want to operate anymore in order to get subsidies for the rest of them. And that's, you know, we're going to be right back fighting this again in a few months.
Well, I'm assuming here that the New York Times ran this story yesterday, that would be May 8th, with some assurance that the towel has been thrown in on TMI-1.
Exelon did issue a press release. So, you know, we've just seen those reversals, specifically in upstate New York, where reactors gave certain closure dates and said, you know, we really mean it. If you don't give us the subsidy, we're closing on this date, and the subsidy was given. So here, you know, you've got Exelon, you've got state legislators in Pennsylvania who are huge servants to Exelon, who have apparently raised the white flag, as Tim said. But just remember what else they're up to. So that's what we have to watch out for.
I think
Have anything to jump in on this one?
Yeah, I interviewed Eric Epstein of Three Mile Island Alert about this was before the bailout, and about some of the unique situations in Pennsylvania that would not necessarily play out in other states. But I would like to take a step back from the front lines where we're talking about, you know, jobs and subsidies and money and all of that, and go into a macro argument that I think that we as a movement need to make. And that is that people have lost track of what the negative impact is of radiation on human body and health and safety and children and fertility and all the rest of it. So if I was born, I lived through the 1950s. I lived through the aftermath of Three Mile Island, so I at least have a base level understanding. But so many of the people who are, say, even under 50, don't understand what's wrong about nuclear. And so they're easily swayed by economic arguments, where there's a much more personal one, as in, Kate Brown, in her book Manual for Survival about Chernobyl, points out that sperm count has gone down by 60% since the 1940s. And she links that up with nuclear. There are other aspects of human health and birth defects and miscarriages and the like that I think we need to be mining for talking points about what we're really talking about here. Because the left brain side of it is all these important issues that have been brought up about money and tax base and jobs and all the rest, all of which are being addressed in different ways by both sides. But the one thing that is being shunted to the side repeatedly are the concerns, particularly of the women, particularly of the mothers, who are in that area and have seen the consequences of Three Mile Island within their families. And I think that by finding a way to frame that argument and let people understand that this is not clean, this is not green. Only if you look at the moment of energy generation, like through a tiny hole in a sheet of steel, can you see it being carbon neutral, and everything else is carbon intensive, but then there's the radiation. We've got to find a way to get those very important arguments, which may be dismissed as being emotional, but there's nothing wrong with emotions in this. We've got to get that into the argument, or we run the risk of people who don't understand the difficulties going the wrong way and voting for the jobs and the money, as opposed to realizing that what they're voting for is really the destruction of the human race.
Well, it's actually quite remarkable, Levi Halevi, that in none of this, and Tim and Kevin, you can take this up, but we've been following these debates, these fights over the bailouts, and in virtually none of it is the calculation on health or safety, for that matter. I mean, these people just, when you raise these issues of people dying in the neighborhoods, which, Joe Mangano and the Radiation Health Project have clearly documented, and which you, Levi, and I have seen, along with Tim and Kevin, in the aftermath of Three Mile Island, in Chernobyl and Fukushima. We've got people out there on the pro-nuclear side denying any of it. I mean, Joe Mangano has demonstrated clearly that when nuclear reactors open, the infant death rate goes up, and when they close, it goes down. Now, the states, Pennsylvania included, do a great job of not studying any of that. I mean, after Three Mile Island, the state of Pennsylvania discontinued its tumor registry and, you know, did everything in its power to no longer look for health impacts. I'm going to guarantee you that with the shutdown of TMI-1, the infant death rate in central Pennsylvania will go down. And it would with Perry and Davis-Bessie and the four upstate reactors in New York. But it is not part of the public dialogue. It's outrageous. And, I'm going to reiterate again, there is absolutely no doubt that Three Mile Island killed people. And yet you still hear these guys running around saying, nobody died at Three Mile Island, which is a complete lie. They're saying that 31 people died at Chernobyl when we have a clear indication that well over a million died. The radiation released at Fukushima has been charted, at least the cesium, at 130 times or more the amounts of cesium released at Hiroshima and Nagasaki, for God's sakes. So, you know, the health aspects have not really entered in, unless I'm missing something, Tim and Kevin. Has it been part of the debate in these bailout fights?
Well, I mean, the activists have been raising the issues about why we shouldn't be using nuclear power in all of these cases. But what you're pointing to, Harvey, is a really important dimension of the overall problem, which is, contrast this a little bit with what's going on with climate change. In the last few years, we've actually really sort of, brought to the forefront and called out the strategy of climate denial that the fossil fuel industry has sort of rolled out over the last couple of decades, to basically, you know, prevent there being any sort of, you know, national consensus around the need to address the climate crisis. But, you know, we've been dealing with, you know, a parallel problem of nuclear denial for decades longer than that, which has been, you know, which comes straight out of the origins of nuclear power, nuclear weapons in the Manhattan Project, and the, you know, the, and the program of national secrecy around this technology. And part of the, you know, the, one of the essential components of the whole enterprise of nuclear power and nuclear weapons has been this practice of denying that there's really any meaningful public risk and public health and, you know, public health impact to the, you know, to this essentially dangerous technology. And, you know, that has had tragic consequences for everyone throughout the entire, you know, nuclear fuel chain, from uranium mining up through, you know, the operation of nuclear reactors to the dumping of radioactive waste. And, you know, and policymakers have been, you know, under the influence of this massive coordinated plan or, you know, or agenda to deny that nuclear power has any environmental impacts. And we have to get past that.
Kevin, you want to jump in on that?
Well, one of the reactors in Ohio that's lined up for these bailouts, if it ever goes through, and we've held them off for many long years, which is a victory in itself, but here they're back at us again like never before. So Davis Bessie just happens to be one of the most dangerous atomic reactors in the United States and perhaps the entire world. And just to get that point across, I was at a Chernobyl 20th anniversary shadow conference in Kiev, Ukraine. It would have been 2006. And there was a Chernobyl whistleblower who was speaking either Ukrainian or Russian, and I was listening to his presentation over headphones that were translating his presentation into English. And I heard him say himself, audibly, Davis Bessie, before I heard the translation, and I almost fell out of my chair. And what he said was, hey, we've been talking about Chernobyl, we've been talking about Russian RBMK reactor designs, how risky they are, of course they are, but you know, it's not just Russian designs. Let me tell you about an American design at Davis Bessie. And what he talked about was the hole in the head fiasco that came to light in 2002, this massive corrosion in the reactor lid at Davis Bessie that was the nearest thing to a meltdown, the closest call since Three Mile Island decades earlier. And so when we entered the fight at Davis Bessie in 2010 to try to block the 20-year license extension, which is the only reason it's still operating right now, it should have shut down on Earth Day 2017. That was the end of the 40 years. We compiled a list of all the near misses at Davis Bessie over the decades. I mean, the first one was a Three Mile Island precursor incident 18 months before Three Mile Island, because Davis Bessie is a twin design. And you just keep adding episodes of near misses at Davis Bessie. So what we titled that compilation was Another 20 Years of Radioactive Russian Roulette on the Great Lakes Shore. And that's what we've entered. You know, we're a couple years into the Davis Bessie license extension. And the irony of the bailout in Ohio would be that Ohio ratepayers would be paying for that radioactive Russian roulette, this ever-deepening risk with age-related degradation, sailing ever deeper into uncharted territory of risk. There's many risks at Davis Bessie, reactor pressure vessel embrittlement, that corrosion problem that's never gone away, the radioactive waste in the pools. Davis Bessie's on a short list of pools in this country, about 13 of the pools in this country, that have suffered leakage. So a high-level radioactive waste storage pool that is leaking. So that's the irony, is that Ohioans are being looked to pay for their own ever-increasing risk at Davis Bessie.
Right, and there's no sense in the discussion from the utility side or the supporter side that the reactor needs to be inspected. You know, they've got this nuclear power portrayed as some kind of black box that just works and works and works, and the only question is, you know, do we turn it on or off? There's no, you know, what we have now in this country is 98 separate issues here. It's not a, there's no, the abstract debate about nuclear power is meaningless. If what we're dealing with is 98, soon to be 96, machines, you know, it's like buying a, and they don't want to look at. It's like buying a car and you don't see if the block is cracked or the brakes work. And it's terrifying. I mean, we cannot get in Ohio, and I've been following it, of course, more closely in Ohio than elsewhere, but it's also true in California. We can't get people to look at these reactors as individual entities. You know, they're all Corvairs, Pintos, and Edsels, for God's sakes. And, you know, and plus we have these idiots running around. You know, finally they get the people to take global warming seriously because it's being used as a pretext to keep nuclear power plants operating. I mean, that is completely and utterly insane. And it's you know, the same people who were dumping all over us for worrying about global warming are now using it as an excuse to keep nuclear power plants operating. I mean, and they're calling nuclear plants emission-free and carbon-free. I mean, you know, talk about your adrenals going bad, Levy. I mean, that just drives me absolutely crazy.
The languaging makes me nuts, but it's also a field of specialty for me as to, you know, how language is used to move people. And the problem we're facing is that the nuclear industry has been allowed to control the languaging and the framing of this argument. And the way I explain it to people is that they're trying to say that it's carbon free. And if you put up a steel plate in front of you and hold it up in front of you and drill a tiny pinprick of a hole all the way through and squint through it at the sole moment of the energy generation, then yeah, they can get away with it. But you take that steel plate away from blocking your vision, and you see the entire fuel chain from uranium mining, which leaves behind the tailings and the poisoned land and water and people there. Then there is transport, and they're not using electric vehicles for this. All of this is carbon intensive. Then it's the refining. Then it's the manufacturing. They bring it to the facility, which had to be built in the first place, which was very carbon intensive. And you've got this split instant where it's not. But then afterwards, we've got these thousands and tens and hundreds of thousands of years of high-level radioactive waste that's going to have to be tended. And there's no way that that's going to be carbon-free. I mean, the nukes themselves aren't even carbon-free because they don't generate their own electricity. It's not like they're generating it and they run a line back in to operate the plant. They've got to pull it off the grid, and God only knows where that energy is coming from. So it is a carbon-intensive, dirty technology from start to finish, except for maybe this tiny thing, which is what the nuclear industry wants people to look at. And we have to find that way to take that block away from their eyes so they see the whole thing and see the way that they are being conned.
Well, nuclear power plants do emit carbon-14, and they do heat the environment directly. Now, you know, we're told that that's a very small piece of the puzzle, but the reality is that they do emit carbon-14, and they do heat the environment directly. So, you know, let's deal with reality here. Tim Judson, what is the fight like in New York now? Is there any resistance? Has anybody come forward to challenge the ongoing bailout of these four reactors?
Well, I mean, you know, yeah, we're actually still involved in a lawsuit to have the whole bailout overturned. And that's, you know, wending its way through the court right now. We're, you know, we're waiting on a ruling or, you know, or a hearing date to be set, you know, to, you know, to at least resolve the, you know, the first legal challenge to the bailout. You know, I think what's also going on right now is, sort of a parallel issue, which is that, you know, there's four reactors that are being bailed out, under this massive subsidy, to continue operating. But there's also two reactors that are going to be closing in the next 2 years at the Indian Point nuclear power plant just north of New York City. And you know what we're seeing happening now actually is a very high level industry financed publicity campaign to essentially create a sort of the public impression that Indian Point's closure, the closure of this large nuclear power plant in New York City that people have been working for decades to close, is going to be turned into a negative by essentially the public impression that it's going to be replaced with fossil fuels. And this is, you know, going back to, you know, the other things we've been talking about, this attempt to essentially muddy the waters and pit different segments of the environmental movement against one another by essentially making it seem like the closure of nuclear power plants is bad for the climate. And this is a really pernicious strategy that the industry is using, to keep the environmental movement divided while they clamor for all of these subsidies. And, you know, we're pretty sure that, you know, I mean, the closure of Indian Point is going to happen. Nothing is going to change that at this point. But this is essentially, you know, a way to try to get the public conditioned to continue paying the bailouts for all of the rest of the nuclear plants in New York State. And this is really an issue that we have to take on to essentially try to unify or reunify the environmental movement around the things that are really the solutions to all these problems, which is sustainable energy. And, you know, whether you're working to stop fracking, or working to stop, coal mining, working to stop fossil fuels, or working to stop nuclear, the solutions to all of these issues are the same. And, you know, what we're seeing happening in California and Germany and, you know, in other parts of the world is that, you know, renewable energy, you know, can take off and expand quickly enough to be able to address the climate crisis and phase out nuclear power. But, you know, we have to have, you know, the public consensus around making that happen, as opposed to fighting over, you know, which dirty energy source we're going to prefer over others.
Well, Tim, real quickly, what makes you so sure that Indian Point's going to shut down?
It's happening. I mean, you know, there's a legal agreement between the state, the environmental organization Riverkeeper, and Entergy to do it. I mean, Entergy's already cut a deal to sell the plants to another company once it's closed for decommissioning. I mean, this is, and there's only one way to get out of it, which is for there to be some sort of an electric, you know, grid emergency, necessary to keep the lights on. And the state has already guaranteed that that's not going to happen by putting in all of the system upgrades that are necessary for Indian Point to turn off, so that won't happen. So Indian Point is closing. There's no doubt about that, you know, in my mind or almost anybody else's in New York. But the issue is whether, you know, we're going to be able to wean the state off of the other nukes, and end these subsidies.
What court are you in fighting the bailout of the other four reactors?
Well, it's the New York State Supreme Court, which, you know, contrary to the way that the federal courts are organized, is actually the lowest level of the New York State court system. So, we filed this lawsuit, a couple of months after the bailout was adopted. And it's, you know, been taking a while to get to a ruling, but we should be having that sometime this year.
Okay. So, and those, there are no other, the two at Indian Point, what are the dates for shutdown at Indian Point?
So Indian Point 2 will shut down permanently in March of 2020, and Indian Point 3 in March of 2021.
Well, it can't be too soon, but okay, I'm going to take your word for it. That they're going to
well,
shut.
I mean, you know, they keep on having safety incidents and equipment problems at that plant. So yeah, it's being held together by their nuclear equivalent of, you know, bubblegum and duct tape. But you're right. Everyone wants to see those reactors shut tomorrow, and we're hoping to get through the next 2 years incident free.
Well, all the reactors all across the country are being held together that way. Very quickly, I want to move on to Kevin. In Ohio, have any of the major politicians in New York come out to criticize the Cuomo's bailout of the four? I'm thinking specifically of Kirsten Gillibrand, who's, of course, running for president, the senator. What has she had to say about the bailouts, if anything?
Sorry, are you asking me? Tim?
Yes, Tim, please. Yeah.
No, I mean the Gillibrand and the other, you know, high level elected officials in New York haven't said anything against it. There is opposition in the state legislature, and the state legislature, introduced legislation 2 years ago to try to overturn the subsidy. The problem was that the governor was the one who made the subsidy happen, and he wasn't going to, you know, he was going to veto that legislation.
And he's still holding fast on this, the governor of Cuomo?
Yeah, we're, you know, what we're anticipating is there's going to be another big fight next year. You know, every 4 to 5 years, New York State, you know, by state law, has to adopt a state energy plan. And in the previous state energy plan, and that was issued in 2015, where they actually set really ambitious goals for, you know, 40% emissions reductions by 2030, 50% renewable energy by 2030, you know, big improvements in energy efficiency. That state energy plan didn't say a single word about propping up nuclear power plants with, you know, with massive subsidies. But a year later, they, you know, the governor pushed through that policy anyway. And, one of our allegations in the lawsuit is that the State Public Service Commission violated the state energy planning law by putting in this massive nuclear subsidy that wasn't part of the state energy plan. And we're really concerned that when the next state energy plan gets drafted next year, that they're going to try to put support for these subsidies in there at that point. And we're working with environmental groups in New York State to make sure that doesn't happen.
In the course of the debate, and even to this point, has anybody in New York sought to inspect these reactors and see what kind of shape they're in?
Tim well, Justin? Nobody has any authority to. I mean, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, by federal law, preempts anyone else, any other state or local agency from doing anything about nuclear safety.
Well, but it can be. But that's the point. If it's framed in terms of safety, that's one thing. But what about framing it in terms of the economic value of the asset? I mean, these plants are being bailed out based on the idea that they have economic value. If nobody, it's like, again, buying a car with a cracked block. I mean, if nobody, it should not be the NRC, well, of course, I'm advocating it, but it should not be the NRC's jurisdiction to do an economic assessment of the value of these reactors. That should be reserved to the people that are bailing them out.
If you want to look at it purely from the standpoint of economics, and I really appreciate, you know, Levy's, you know, point before about this ultimately not being an economic issue, even though those are the terms we're forced to debate it in. These reactors have no economic value in terms of, especially in terms of addressing a situation like climate. Of the four reactors that are being subsidized in New York, two of them are going to be closed by 2030 anyway because their licenses expire, and they're two of the oldest reactors in the world. One of the other two was already going to close before the bailout was enacted because it was uneconomical and unprofitable to operate. So, you know, if we're talking about how we're going to be meeting our emissions goals to mitigate the climate crisis, you know, nuclear power isn't going to be around long enough to make a difference. So why are we putting billions of dollars into subsidizing these old reactors instead of putting it into renewables and efficiency? And, you know, there was actually a study done during the debate over the nuclear subsidy that showed that if New York created an energy efficiency program that was really ambitious, like what's happening in some other states, that they could actually reduce electricity consumption in New York by 2030 by the same amount of electricity as these four reactors generate, but saving ratepayers $3 billion in cost. So instead of saving $3 billion, by doing energy efficiency, the state is spending $7.5 billion to prop up these old reactors that are going to be shutting down anyway. I mean, that's not how we're going to solve a climate crisis, by making decisions that cost $10.5 billion more to do less.
Let's switch. Thank you, Tim. I mean, it's mind-boggling how stupid this is. Let's go to the pinnacle of stupidity here, which is Ohio. And nobody knows more about Davis, Bessie, and Perry than Kevin Camp. So, Kevin, what is happening now in Ohio? They're really, obviously, they're down to the wire here. This is the big all-out push now to bail out Perry and Davis, Bessie. You've got heavily gerrymandered state legislature with big Republican majorities. You have a governor who's, you know, pro-nuclear, Mike DeWine. Give us a sense of the battle here.
Well, sadly, I mean, listening to what Tim just said about New York, Ohio Republicans who are in the pocket of First Energy have been very effective, unfortunately, tragically, at sabotaging renewables in the state of Ohio. So by creating a very strict, impossibly strict setback distance for wind turbine towers in Ohio, for the past 5 years, they have effectively sabotaged the development of wind. And there's tremendous wind potential in Ohio. I mean, the Lake Erie Shore is one of the best potential wind power generation sites in the country. And then you've got great transmission already there. You've got major cities that need the electricity, like Cleveland. And so, unfortunately, the Republicans at the behest of First Nuclear have been very effective at just blocking renewable development in Ohio. And this latest bailout would be, you know, another chapter in that with no end date attached to it. And First Energy has been so effective at campaign contributions and lobbying in Ohio at the state level that they've essentially handpicked the current House of Representatives Speaker, Householder is his name, ironically, and he is the sponsor of this latest bailout attempt. So it's just very corrupt cronyism that's going on. And we're lucky to have some great allies on the ground, though, like Environmental Defense Fund, which is not anti-nuclear by any stretch of the imagination, but they are anti-subsidy, and especially in this circumstance. And so they've actually helped lead the fight in Ohio against these subsidies. And like I said, we have held them off for several long years, despite their best efforts. And another ally I need to mention is the Beyond Coal campaign at Sierra Club, because it's not just the reactors that would get bailed out. It's also, and it, as I said, it's amorphous. It morphs by the day, but coal and even natural gas is still in the running to receive these subsidies. It seems to just be solar and wind that gets excluded every time. So it's a fast moving target in Ohio, a lot of good people fighting. Some more good news would be that a couple pieces. One is on the latest round of bailout bill, which again is mostly about the reactors, there were more than 80 comments submitted in the last couple 3 days at the Ohio State Legislature. Only a couple of them were in favor of the bailout, and guess what? It was First Energy representatives. There were five who maintained neutrality, including the head of the Public Service Commission, or the PUCO, the Public Utility Commission of Ohio. But then the vast majority, like 75 of the 82 comments submitted, were opposed to the bailout. So there's some good news. And you mentioned the bankruptcies, Harvey. Some more good news is the bankruptcy judge overseeing First Energy's bankruptcy did not allow for First Energy parent company to simply walk away from the coal messes and perhaps even the nuclear messes that it has made in Ohio. They just wanted to walk away and have no liability for the messes they've made. They've created this spinoff company called First Energy Solutions that would protect the mothership and its money. And the bankruptcy judge said, nope, you're not walking away from this mess you've made. So, you know, a call out, a shout out to Environmental Law and Policy Center of Chicago, Howard Lerner. They were really going after the inadequacy of the decommissioning funds at the Ohio reactors for years now under the NRC's emergency enforcement petition process. So a lot of good people doing a lot of good work in Ohio on this.
So what's the key to winning in Ohio? I mean, it's not a done deal that we've lost it, right? I mean, we still have a chance to stop this bailout.
No, it's not a done deal. We just got to keep redoubling efforts and showing up at every juncture like we just did the last couple days with, like I said, 75 of the 82 testimonials were opposed to the bailout, just like happened a couple weeks back with the previous iteration of the bill. So a lot of work to do in Ohio. I mean, some bad news is the Democrats in Ohio, who are a small minority in the Ohio State Legislature, I don't know what they're thinking. They said, yeah, we support, you know, continuing forward into the future with these old reactors and bailing them out, subsidizing them. So obviously a lot of education has to take place in Ohio.
Really. Kevin?
Well, we're almost
Kevin,
at the end.
Question.
I mean, we could go on.
If I may, Harvey.
Tell us who you are.
What, if anything, can
we're
people
to,
outside of Los Angeles, outside of Ohio do to be for the effort that's going on there?
Well, I encourage folks in Ohio to activate them. Let them know that now's the time to be in touch with their own governor, their own state legislators. So just spread the word to folks you know in Ohio or groups you're a part of. that have a presence there, just alert them. Same in Pennsylvania.
Vivi, however, you are author. You have the nuclear hot seat. You're author of Yes, I Go in the Dark. How do people get a hold of you?
They can go to nuclearhotseat.com. They can send an email to info@nuclearhotseat.com. I invite them to the website where they can sign up for an email once a week with each week's episode there. And there's an archive of more than 400 episodes that they can go and scroll back and check into if they want to find out about any of these issues.
Tim, thank you so much, Libby. You're always fabulous. Tim Judson?
Yeah, thanks, Harvey. So people can find us on the web at www.nirs.org, N-I-R-S.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at NIRSNet.
Okay, and Kevin Camps, you're at Beyond Nuclear as always. We will have you all back.
Yeah, BeyondNuclear.org. That's us.
Yes, indeed. And BeyondNuclear.org. Let's celebrate two more shutdowns and 96 to go. Thank you both. And thank you, crew in New York. We'll see you next week.
Solotropia, 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 don't you know we're gonna have a solotropia?